Hi.
New York, New York, 10036. Pro country.
What you see is what you get.
Hell has no fury. He drives the most expensive car because second best never enters his mind.
Of all the billions of planets in space, only one is off limits to man.
It all began with a curse.
The evil you did this day will be avenged.
A curse.
From the mists of infinity, they come, rising from the cold, damp earth to take what is now theirs.
You are in a room filled with your friends, but they are all dead.
Night, when the earth is quiet, and the good people of the world are sleeping, the night visitor comes to call.
The streets have been taken over by thieves, dope addicts, rapists, muggers. We live in fear. One man is doing something about it.
These are the sounds of 6 feet of silver death.
Grindhouse Purgatory, 42nd Street, Pete.
It's time to dip back into the purgatory of the Grindhouse with Pete, 42nd Street, Shirilla.
Yeah, we're back. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your turkey and all that other good shit that went with it, you know?
See, the way I look at it is, most people spent that day getting stuffed, whether it was in bed or at the kitchen table. You're still getting stuffed.
A lot of people spent that day watching movies.
As they should have.
Yes, yes.
Speaking of movies, though, that's what this show is about, Grindhouse Purgatory. Now, the Grindhouse had so many subgenres within it. I mean, when you were at 42nd Street going through all these things, what was your favorite genre? Westerns, sexploitation, hardcore, cannibal, sci-fi, straight-up slasher by the time you got to the early 80s? Which was your favorite subgenre, or didn't you have a favorite?
No, actually, I didn't have a favorite, but being that you did bring this up, and one of the first things out of your mouth was spaghetti westerns, coming up next month, unfortunately, December 16th, we lost a true legend in the spaghetti westerns and a true grindhouse legend in itself, Lee Van Cleef. And, you know, that was a grindhouse thing where one of the first double bills that kept bouncing around the grindhouses, and I'm going to say, shit, 68 maybe, 69, was Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is that a Fistful for a Few Dollars More resurrected Lee Van Cleef's acting career. And what had happened was he had basically dropped off the radar somewhere in the late 50s because he was tired of the typecasting. And, you know, you as a fan, you watched a lot more TV than I did. But, you know, he was like a fixture in all those westerns that populated the TV in the 60s and stuff like that. And also was on a pivotal episode of The Twilight Zone. I think it was called The Grave with him, Strother Martin, and James Best.
Now, and see, when you mention Lee Van Cleef, I know him best from like Escape from New York or The Master or The Octagon. And I from his really early 80s stuff, that's where I know Lee Van Cleef the most.
Yeah, see, that was his later stuff. See, what happened was, the legend goes, and it's, you know, you don't want to believe at certain some points, the reason for A Few Dollars More got its title was because Leone had come over to America to hire Henry Fonda to be in for A Few Dollars More. Of course, Henry Fonda didn't know who the fuck Sergio Leone was at this point. So he had other choices. He had Charles Bronson, who was actually in the running for the first one, but blew it off and blew this one off. Lee Marvin was interested, but then he got Cat Ballou. We all know how that panned out. Charlton Heston was approached. He wasn't interested. James Coburn was, but at the last minute wanted a lot more money than they were willing to pay. So legend has it that they were in a bar commiserating this whole, you know, so far failed trip when in walked Lee Van Cleef, who, like I had said, hadn't been working. And Leone looked at him and recognized him from his first movie, High Noon, and approached him. They started talking, and they went out in the parking lot, and supposedly a bag was opened that contained $15,000. So they basically hopped a plane with Lee Van Cleef, and they got him for a few dollars more. That's how that all worked. Sort of Eastwood had sort of stepped back in that film, and it was more Van Cleef's film than Eastwood's, as Eli Wallach's was more The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly than either one of them, because he overshadowed both of them in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. In between that, Van Cleef had done the big gun down for Sergio Somaliello, which was a political-type Western, but the horse was out of the gate now. So the minute Eastwood had quit, you know, doing Westerns and come back to America to work, Van Cleef was the king. A lot of guys that I ran into, you know, including, you know, Tom Atkins from Escape from New York had told me stories about him. Tom Atkins had told me that he was basically dying on the set of Escape to New York because he was exposed to radiation, as a lot of the cast of The Conqueror were, that John Wayne film that was shot out by the A-bomb tests.
Howard Hughes' stupid decision.
Yeah. And Tom had told me that, you know, he didn't work with any of the other cast except Lee. They shot their stuff in Los Angeles. The rest of the stuff was shot in St. Louis. So he said that, you know, Lee was basically dying then, but I don't think so. I think he must have went into remission because he went on to do The Master in Fred Olen Ray's movie, Armed Response, which was one of the last Grindhouse movies that he appeared in, and, you know, a bunch of other stuff. But the interesting thing is that they paired him with Jim Brown in El Condor. And up until that point, you know, Lee was this cool gunslinger where all of a sudden he became this unhinged, drunken prospector with a flair for violence.
See, this is what I kind of want to know. Now, I was only 9 years old when The Master hit the air. And I think it was NBC. And you have to wonder, was Lee Van Cleef that big of a name that the mainstream would know who he was? Because if you look at the advertising for The Master, and Lee Van Cleef as The Master, and do you really think the mainstream public knew who the hell he was to you know, headline in a primetime action show?
Sure, he was over huge in the 70s. I mean, he was always working, but, you know, the problem was him and Kinski stayed in Europe too long. If they had come back earlier, they would have been on a par with Eastwood and Bronson as far as starring power. But they were, you know, especially Van Cleef was a known name. I mean, remember the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms?
Yeah.
Okay. He was actually on, you know, billed on the ad, like the one sheet for that. And the line in that movie was that they hand him a gun and he goes, you ever use one of these? He goes, yeah, I could pick my teeth with it. And he was only 20-something years old then. When he hit the big time, they ran a revival of The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms somewhere, and so, starring Lee Van Cleef in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. He was only in the fucking thing for like the last 10 minutes. So yeah, he was over. He was over as a personality and a star.
Wasn't Eastwood in Tarantula?
Yeah, he was a fighter pilot in Tarantula and a lab technician in Revenge of the Creature.
Yeah, and he's got like one or two lines of dialogue in each one, and that's about it.
Yeah, and him and Burt Reynolds were fired on the same day for basically, as far as Universal was concerned, they had no potential, no future.
Well, it's always funny when you see something like that. Like, did you ever see the 1980 movie? In Australia, it was The Chain Reaction. Over here, it was called Nuclear Run. It was by George Miller. This was prior to Road Warrior, but after Mad Max.
No, I didn't see that one.
If you see the DVD, it's starring Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
And Mel Gibson is in it with a giant long beard with three lines of dialogue from underneath a car. Cause this is before Mad Max came out. So Mel Gibson wasn't a star, but my God, is he plastered on all of the DVD and VHS art.
Oh, sure. See, that was the whole thing, because once somebody was over, they would dig up stuff that he had done. Like there was a couple, when Eastwood was over, they threw some minor Western he was in out. You know, they re-released it, starring Clint Eastwood. They did the same thing with Bronson. I can't remember the names of the movies, but they were minor roles in minor Westerns. But, okay, the name's out there, so they used it. I had talked to, like, you know, a couple people, you know, about, you know, that worked with Lee Van Cleef, John Philip Law, before he passed away. And he said, you know, that Lee was starting to get sick during Death Rides a Horse, and Michael Callan, who worked with him in the Magnificent Seven ride, said, yeah, that he was very sick on that set because I guess the cancer had kicked in. Plus, you know, there was no bones about it. Lee was a heavy drinker. You know, he was one of those guys, he was a functioning alcoholic. Fred Olin Ray told me that he had to pick him up and drive him back and forth for armed response because he didn't trust himself to drive anymore.
See, the way I look at it is, obviously you have Lee Van Cleef and you have Clint Eastwood in that. For me, I've never been comfortable with the term spaghetti westerns. I've always found that to be kind of a derogatory term. Yes, a lot of these westerns came from Italy, so the spaghetti western thing, I get that. I just always found it to be derogatory. A lot of these, now I'm looking at this from a much younger perspective, Pete.
Yeah.
A lot of these are pretty bad. I don't mean just, oh, they're, you know, the dubbing or whatnot. I mean, like, these are just, they're cookie cutter westerns. I've seen so many that there are so few that actually were good to me. I'm not a big western guy, but I don't know, the spaghetti westerns just seem so bland to me.
Well, you know, like you just said it, you're not a western guy where, you know, I got a lot of years on you, so I was, you know, exposed to a lot, you know, a lot of other stuff. And the big thing with TV in the 60s was primarily westerns. That's what it was. And even Eastwood was in Rawhide. You know, you had Rawhide, you had Laredo, you had Sugarfoot, you had Cheyenne, you had, look at Gunsmoke. Gunsmoke was the longest running TV series for like over two fucking, almost three decades.
Until Law and Order, I think. And then Law and Order was surpassed by The Simpsons.
Yeah. But, you know, the westerns were like the staple of, you know, my growing up because that's what you fucking watched. That was on TV. So, you know, I saw all these guys and like, you know, it was funny. I was just talking to Gary Kent, who stunt doubled a lot of these guys. And we were talking about, you know, Robert Vaughn had just passed away. And he says, I loved working with Rob. I stunt doubled many times on Man from U.N.C.L.E. That was one of the few things that came in the interim was, you know, when you hit the seven, like when the 60s got hit, you know, toward the mid 60s, late 60s, you know, Man from U.N.C.L.E. was a hip show. And Gary, you know, had a lot of work because of TV back then, you know, doing stunts. And that's why a lot of these character actors, like, you know, Van Cleef, Jack Elam, R.G. Armstrong, even George Kennedy, Warren Oates, all them guys were just up and coming, but they had a ton of fucking work because of television. Then they, you know, they spread out into the movies. But, you know, the thing was with spaghetti westerns, it paid for whoever was producing these things to somehow get some kind of an American name in there, no matter how minor, because it would legitimize the film worldwide. That's why, you know, guys that were like, you know, sort of like on their last legs, like John Ireland and Cameron Mitchell went over there and did a few for the payday. Alex Nicole was another one. Jack Elam did a couple. Some guys that really worked. I'm trying to think of the guy. He did a Fulci film. Brett.
Fulci did, I remember Fulci's Western Massacre Time. Was yeah. actually one of the really, really good ones. The only thing that pissed me off in that movie was when the horse steps on the mine, it's clearly a real horse that they blew up for that movie. Cause, you know, Italy and the whole animal cruelty thing, even the Westerns couldn't get away from that shit.
Yeah, Kinski was bitching about with the horses too because he got fucking hurt in a bad stunt with the horses where they tripped the horses up, you know, that whole deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was even bitching about that. I
will never sit still for animal cruelty in a film. That's one of the things I'll never forgive. Whenever I watch a 70s Italian exploitation movie, no matter the subgenre, I'm always afraid, oh fuck, is there going to be an animal killed in this one? Because that just pisses me off.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the guy's name. He was in a Fulci film. It was a TV movie though that Shriek Show was selling, Touch of Death.
I don't know if I've seen that one, or at least not under that title.
I'm gonna say Brett Hazley. That's who it was. He made a living over there. He changed his name by a couple aliases, but it was Brett Hazley.
The way I look at it is, like Franco Nero, obviously, you know, was in the first Django, and then you know the later 1987 Django sequel. But then, like, you had all of those Django knockoffs that came out, and they weren't even all Italian. There were Spanish westerns.
Yeah.
Franco Nero and they called them fucking Django movies. Well, like those are just not good films for the most part.
I know what they were doing was, especially in Germany, because Nero was over like a motherfucker in Germany, that any film that came into Germany that he was in, that was a Western, they changed the title to a Django title. So there were over 50 in name only sequels and knockoffs to Django. The only one that you know really is original is the Django Strikes Again one, because
the 1987 one.
Yeah, he was down in South America with Ted Post, and they were talking about Django, and he goes, "Well, how come you never made a sequel?" And he goes, "Well, nobody ever approached me." So they, you know, here we are. We're in South America. It looks sort of like Westernish, you know. So they had contacted Sergio Corbucci and got his blessing to do it, and that's how the only, you know, real sequel came out.
Well, they were supposed to make a real sequel a few years ago. Writer Mike Malloy came up with a really, I thought, ingenious way to bring, you know, older Franco Nero into the fold to make an official Django third movie. And then Tarantino's movie came out and no studio would back it because they said to the mainstream public, Django's a black guy. We can't have a Django movie starring Franco Nero now.
Well, you could. From what I understand now, I might be wrong. I read somewhere that it was given to John Sayles to write and direct.
The Mike Malloy script, and I might be getting a few of the details wrong. It's been a couple of years since I read all this, but it would be set in the early 1900s during the silent era of movies, and Django is now a technical consultant in Hollywood on the westerns that they're making when some bounty hunters from his past meet up with him in old Hollywood. And I thought, that sounds really fucking good.
Oh, it does. I don't know what the deal is. I only read this a couple months ago that something was going on and John Sayles was involved with writing it and directing it.
And I just like the idea of, like, you know, Django in old Hollywood.
Yeah, that would work. I don't know. Maybe, there's an off chance that maybe, you know, I don't know if you talked to Mike or not. Maybe Mike, you know, sold Sayles, you know, what he wrote, or maybe who the fuck knows, you know?
I don't know, but I thought Mike Malloy came up with a pretty goddamn original idea on how to make, you know, because Nero's what, 70 now, maybe?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's getting, I saw him in that Eurocrime documentary recently, and he's still looking pretty damn fit though.
Yeah, well, you know, the killer part is we didn't know he was in New York for a couple of years just hanging out doing nothing because his wife was on Broadway.
I didn't know that either.
We could have got him we were pissed. We could have got him to Wasteland or someplace, you know, a show. I mean, he was just pretty much just hanging out doing nothing, you know?
Now, I don't know how he is personally, but he seems like a pretty laid back, you know, things happen kind of guy. I don't know if that's the way he actually is or not, but whenever I see him in an interview, that's the way he seems. He just seems like a cool guy to hang out with.
Hey, you never know about these people. You know, it's like Ruggiero Deodato, Cannibal Holocaust. You know, what would you expect that man to be like in person? What a sweetheart of a guy. I mean, he was right behind me at Wasteland. I went to go take a piss or something, and I come back and it was like $50 on my chair. And I go, "What's this for?" To the guy, it was helping me. And he goes, "Oh, Ruggiero just took five Jungle Holocaust because he ran out." I said, "I don't want to make money off the guy." So I went over, you know, I gave him like $20 back. I didn't give a shit, you know, broke even on the deal. All right. So I go away again. When I come back, there's a stack of signed shit on my chair from him. Some of these guys are really cool. Others, you know, they're pricks, but we're not going to get into that. We're talking about movies.
So, like, with the Westerns, what grindhouse Westerns do you think worked the best? Like I pointed out, I thought Massacre Time, I really didn't think, cause it's a public domain movie. It was one of the Django ripoffs. And yes, it was directed by Lucio Fulci. That's why I actually went, you know what? Let's check this out. I was expecting the same kind of garbage I'd gotten from a lot of the other Django ripoffs. And when I watched this one, I went, this is a surprisingly tight story with good characters. It's unpredictable. And other than the animal cruelty, I said, this was a pretty damn good movie.
Oh, what other ones would stand out? Well, the biggest one was Sabata, and I believe came over here like 72, I think. But there was a huge push with that. And one of my fondest memories of 42nd Street was walking down the block. And this also happened with The Hills Have Eyes. They had a standee of Van Cleef is Sabata on top of one of the theaters. And underneath it, it said, "Lee Van Cleef is Sabata. The man with the gun side eyes comes to kill." I popped fucking huge for that. And when they did The Hills Have Eyes, they had the whole same thing with Berryman's face up there. So people don't know how to fucking promote, you know, these days. They did back then. Another one that really hung around and was nasty and gory and was Spanish was The Cutthroats Nine.
Do you think that given the grindhouse aesthetic, that Westerns fit as well as, say, the cannibal movies or sexploitation or something like that? Because Westerns, when you say Westerns, you think of Gunsmoke or things like that. You think of the John Wayne movies and whatnot. People don't really realize that Westerns got fucking sleazy in the 70s.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, okay, there's the one that kicked open the door, The Wild Bunch, Soldier Blue, The Hunting Party. I mean, these were all just like, okay, you know, The Wild Bunch is a classic, but it kicked open the door for the bloodbaths, the slow-motion dance of death. And, you know, Soldier Blue, they're wiping out the Indians, decapitating them and shit like that. The Hunting Party, Gene Hackman's hunting Oliver Reed's gang with long-range rifles and blowing their heads apart. I mean, this was some fucking wild shit. Even that John Wayne movie, Big Jake, that was a little bit over the top even for the Duke. He had to up the ante in the violence department to stay, you know, to stay relevant. So, yeah.
Okay, then how do you think cross-subgenre Westerns worked? Like when you had the blaxploitation Westerns like Boss Nigger and things like that. Do you think that was just kind of a, what the hell were you thinking? Or
no,
that was inventive.
Fred Williamson knew exactly what he was thinking, and he even admitted it. He goes, I knew I would piss people off if I fucking put, you know, Legend of Nigger, Charlie, Boss Nigger, shit like that. You know, it's the same thing. Like I was talking about, you know, Jim Brown hooking up with Lee Van Cleef and Al Condor. Up until that point with Brown, okay, yeah, he was working since the Dirty Dozen, but he couldn't carry a film for some reason. They didn't trust him enough to carry a film. They put him with people who they knew could carry films, like Ernest Borgnine, Donald Sutherland, Gene Hackman, you know, people like that. But when they put him with Van Cleef sort of like gave him the fucking rub because Van Cleef was so hot at the time. Then, you know, Jim worked with him in two other films. But after that, all of a sudden, here's Jim Brown as Slaughter, you know? So he got the fucking rub. You know, the other one was the mixing of the kung fu shit with the spaghetti westerns. That was another one.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I know you weren't a big TV guy, but I'm sure you went through, you saw David Carradine's Kung Fu. That was a kung fu western TV series.
Yeah, I know.
Well, and it was a damn good one.
Yeah, but see, that spawned, you know, okay, well, why don't we put the fastest gun in the West, Lee Van Cleef, for the deadliest hands in the East, Lo Lee from the Five Fingers of Death. So you had Stranger and the Gunfighter, a.k.a. Blood Money. So, and then the other one was Shanghai Joe.
And see, personally, those are the ones I enjoyed the most. Because, see, like I said earlier, I'm not a straight western kind of guy. But when you throw in a different genre in there, for some reason, I'm a little more open to it. Maybe that makes me shallow when it comes to that. I just, a straight western, no. But if you throw in kung fu or blaxploitation or a horror movie aspect, now you've got my attention.
Okay, you know how we're going to end this segment? I'm going to tell you what killed the spaghetti westerns. What do you think it was? One film killed off the spaghetti westerns. Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles is a good way to go out because it's a great movie.
Well, you know why? Because up until that point, these things were like, you know, incredibly violent and over the top. But Italian filmmakers are notoriously copycatters of American films. And it started with My Name is Nobody, which is a Leone film. And that was the last Western he made was, you know, My Name is Nobody. But it started drifting into like self-parody, like even Van Cleef with Bad Man's River and Captain Apache, where he played an Indian and they dyed him copper and shit. So, yeah, that was the segue out, because after that, they started dropping off in popularity because their attempts to be funny were, like, really fucking stupid, and it just didn't work. I mean, okay, Terrence Hill with My Name is Nobody, and, you know, he did that whole other deal, can't remember what it was, but he teamed up with Bud Spencer for a lot of shit, but basically it was a comedy team, and they turned from doing westerns to doing cop comedy. That's how the spaghetti westerns ended.
Well, usually most genres kind of go out, or subgenres really go out once the parody starts kicking in really fierce. Like, you knew the slasher genre was on its way out when you had all of the parodies of them coming out and whatnot. That's usually the death knell of a subgenre.
The subgenres have a life expectancy anywhere from 3 to 7 years. That's about it. Then it just stole. See, spaghetti westerns ran longer than that because there was just more shit going on. But, you know, you go blaxploitation, it was a 70s thing up until, like, about 1981, then crapped out. The cannibal cycle maybe was 5 years and crapped out.
there's also oversaturation as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in within that, like, 5 to 7 years that you're talking about, there were 67 fake Django movies made alone.
Yeah.
That's an oversaturation of the market.
Yeah, well, all they were doing was just, like I say, taking other films and title them differently. I've got stuff, there was a 6-movie set out called, you know, a Django collection, but it's not Django films. A matter of fact, some of the films don't even have the Django on the title when you watch them, and they're all, like, decent spaghetti westerns.
I think I might have that same set.
Yeah.
I think that's the one that had Massacre Time on it.
Yeah, probably did. But there's 2 sets out. I just ordered the second one, but I bought those standalones from bootleggers at conventions and shit like that, and they were pretty halfway decent movies. And then when this came out, I'm like, oh, these guys are sucking. Like, they're letterboxed, they're widescreen, they're cleaned up. I'm like, hey, fuck it, for $15, you can't go wrong. So.
Hey, I just bought on an early 2000, it's from the year 2000 but from Platinum Disc Corporation, that public domain Bruce exploitation movie, Fist of Fear, Touch of Death. It's widescreen.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd ever seen that widescreen before.
It's amazing what you can find. I the Uncut Devil's Nightmare is on that. Well, it doesn't even exist anymore, that cheapo label Diamond DVD. And that's the uncut version where they stab a baby in the beginning.
All that said, if people want to contact 42nd Street Pete, where can they do so?
Get me on Facebook. Everybody else does. Friend request or whatever. I'm under my real name, Pete Chiarella. Or you can email me directly at 40deuce@hotmail.com.
This has been a 1201 Beyond production. Find it and other great content at 1201beyond.com.